herzlich willkommen. Hello and welcome to a new episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast on history and politics, this time again in English. My name is Gabriele Wojdelko, and as always, this episode deals with the question why and how history shapes the present. But hold on for a second. Today, it's slightly different and really special because we are facing a friendly takeover. I'd like to warmly welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who are hosting our new four-part special summer series, The New Germany. Germany after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, after the German Chancellor's proclamation of a Zeitenwende, the dawn of a new era. All the while keeping an eye on history, of course, as you are used to it from our podcast. Welcome, Katja and Oliver, over to you, and now let's get started.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of The New Germany, the final installment of the special English language series from the History and Politics podcast of the Körber Stiftung. Today we will turn our attention to memories, those that have shaped the nation. Is it time for Germany to move on or to look back? Building on the previous three episodes in which we discussed the... it'll come to me in a minute.
Katja, please don't tell me that this is an attempt to open an episode on national memory with a lame joke about forgetting the intro.
Oh, I thought it was rather good. Forgetting memory, no?
Moving very swiftly on, this barrel of laughs over there is Katja Heuer, a German historian based in Britain.
And my delightfully grumpy friend at the other end is Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin. As I was saying before, I was rudely interrupted by a certain Englishman who had clearly lived away from his polite home country for too long. This episode is about the nation's memory.
It's often been said that Germany is very conscious of its own history and is constantly looking for ways to overcome it. The very concept of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, dealing with the past rather than commemorating it, is unique to the country. In its obsession with looking back, is Germany getting lost on its way into the future?
I don't think Germany can get lost. It's right in the middle of Europe. It's the largest country in it. It's right there.
Katja Heuer, you are on fire today. Let me try again. When the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced that the war in Ukraine would be a Zeitenwende, a turning point for Germany, he meant it in more than just the literal sense of security policy. The return of a large-scale conventional war to European soil shook the very foundations of modern Germany's self-image and of the point it had reached in its own history. The relatively peaceful decade since 1990 had given many the impression that Germany and Europe had reached the end of history, in a way. However, with the attack on Ukraine, Scholz declared, we have entered a new era. That suggests, perhaps, that there never was a happy ending, merely a relatively quiet chapter in the book of German history. Which raises several questions. What will this new era look like? What exactly defines the era Germany is supposed to have come out of with the attack on Ukraine? And does Germany actually ever leave any era behind?
Ooh, I love it when you talk like a historian. Okay, then let's talk eras, past, present and future. And let's see if we can find Germany in the process. Eras are certainly a good starting point, I think, because German history is usually thought of as distinct segments with clear beginnings and endings. People speak of the Weimar years,
the Nazi era,
Wilhelmine Germany,
the Deutsche Teilung or the divided Germany.
Exactly. But does that compartmentalization of history mean that the nation has no long-term memory, no strands of continuity? I certainly think that Germany is more uncomfortable with the notion of continuity than others. It prefers breaks and fresh starts to a more fluid notion of change because it suggests that bad things can just be left behind. There's some comfort in the idea that the lid of history can just be shut on dark aspects of the past. The monsters within can then be studied and exhibited from a position of safety.
The monsters within. Do you know, I think this is an incredibly tricky question to tease apart. Because on the one hand, there's patently no other country in the world that has devoted so much critical attention to its own history, up to the point of often recasting everything that came before the Third Reich as a sort of inexorable slide into moral turpitude. The other day I was at a reception and met a diplomat from a country that had suffered tremendously under British rule, and they were piling praise on Germany for the way it had wrestled with its own burden of shame, and suggesting that the UK should do exactly the same thing. And I don't really think there's anyone who would seriously tell you that this process of coming to terms with the past has ever finished. It's a work in progress. At the same time, though, I think it has ossified in some ways, and that the lessons you can politely draw from German history sometimes tend to be quite narrow, especially in terms of modern Germany's obligations to its neighbours in Eastern Europe, or the distinction between feeling a sense of guilt for your past and a sense of responsibility in the present. And the other thing, which I'm sure we'll end up addressing quite a lot in this episode, is that there are national myths from long before the Nazi age that were kind of corrupted by its legacy and haven't really been repurposed or re-examined for the 21st century, even though every German schoolchild knows about them.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Germany feels the sort of need to poke around in its past more than anybody else, but at the same time refuses to draw kind of parallels or kind of lines of continuity. It's always done from behind a safe line that's been drawn in the sand to eras that have come before, with the under the assumption that you wouldn't necessarily want to go back there, and it's not going to happen. So in a way, as you say, it's ossified to a point where this is ancient history, so we can talk about it and look at it safely.
Well, if the national memory is so much in flux, why don't we go on a tour of sorts to see if we can find the physical traces that might help us piece together Germany's self-image? What's up? There might be ice cream and Bismarck Towers.
Well, you sounded just like my dad there, I'm sorry to say. Excuse me while I get comfortable on my sofa and tell Dr. Moody about my childhood trauma.
I'm not the man to deal with your daddy issues, Katja.
I was hoping you might be. Perhaps our listeners can help. You see, in the 1990s, when all the other East German teenagers got to go on exciting new foreign holidays, since we now had freedom of travel after the Berlin Wall came down, everyone went on really interesting all-inclusive holidays to Greece or Spain or Turkey, but not Katja. Oh no, Katja's papa said, let's go on a tour of sorts and see if we can find physical traces that might help us piece together Germany's self-image. There are only so many ice creams you can buy to make another 19th century statue of some ancient Germanic hero appealing, I'm sorry.
Well, all that suffering and all those ice creams were not in vain, because it sounds as if you have exactly the required experience to be our tour guide on this trip down German memory lane. You know, there's books that tell you 1,001 places you have to see before you die. Why don't we do 5 places you have to have seen to understand Germany?
Well, I hope my publishers are listening. I've just had an excellent idea for my next book.
All right, Katja, get back in your chaise longue. Go on, start us off then. Where did your father drag you to and why?
Well, I think one of the places that stuck with me the most was Valhalla. And no, my father is not a Norse god. Valhalla is a sort of hall of fame of sorts, which was built in Bavaria in the 19th century. It's really quite a grand, impressive location. It sort of sits above the Danube and then overlooks the sort of really rather lovely landscape down there. This was before Germany existed as a nation state, and it was really kind of conceived by the King of Bavaria as a response to the way that Napoleon, when he invaded the German lands, was able to pick on the individual German states and either make them allies or defeat them. But the idea that it was lack of German unity that had caused the sort of humiliating defeat of the German states under Napoleon was what inspired this. And so the Bavarian king basically had this kind of grand hall built, as he said, to honor politicians, sovereigns, scientists, and artists of the German tongue. So the only requirement to have a bust in this hall of honor is that you speak German as your mother tongue. So it contains such illustrious figures as Beethoven and Frederick the Great and Martin Luther, and more recently Sophie Scholl, for instance, who sort of was a kind of brave resistance fighter against the Nazis. And this really kind of stuck with me. I remember like walking around this as a kid, you know, kind of looking at all of these different busts and being kind of, you know, in awe of all of this greatness that I was supposedly surrounded by.
Yeah, I find this whole thing about the German mother tongue strange. It's at once a very generous and also strangely parsimonious definition of Germanity. So you got Copernicus and Mendel in there, who I would think of as bohemians, if anything, but not Kafka. You got Adenauer, the first post-war West German Chancellor, but not Willy Brandt, his social democratic successor. You've got Catherine the Great, the Empress of Russia, who was a German by birth. But you've also got William of Orange.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the origins, really, because they couldn't really define a geographical dimension to this. It was very hard to pin down Germanness, you know, given that there were no national borders. But at the same time, you know, using the German tongue, like what you define as somebody's mother tongue, and also, you know, which of the dialects that exist in Central Europe actually count as German and which don't. So it's certainly a very, very loose definition. And it's, I think if there were a lot more spaces today, in it, which there aren't, there are only three plinths left, and I'll tell you in a minute why I looked this up. you know, I think there would be a much, much bigger debate today as to who should go in there and who should not, just because the, you know, concepts of A, who's German, and B, who's great in that sense, national greatness basically is a lot more difficult now to discern.
Yeah, and I think there's only really a kind of meaningful point to this form of commemoration in the 21st century, if you can get relegated as well as promoted. So in my view, they ought to chuck out some of the dead wood, like, I don't know, Charles X, Gustav of Sweden. Sorry if there are any Swedish monarchists listening to this who are appalled by that proposal. And you ought to be able to replace them with people like Hannah Arendt. I find it bizarre that she isn't in there.
I think because of the way that obviously during the 19th century it was already so populated and there really wasn't much space left. I mean, when I was walking around it as a kid, I was kind of looking at to find empty spaces. And I sort of found one right above the door. Yeah, pretty much that was the idea. So I turned around and there was one right above the entrance door, and that totally fascinated me. So I just pointed at that and went, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I want my bust up there. So I still have to find a way to national German greatness, which I haven't quite managed yet, but maybe one day. So if you could have your pick, who would you put on the remaining plinths?
Well, my other problem with this pantheon of German greatness, apart from the fact that it's stuffed with Dutch people, is that it's an absolute sausage fest. That there are so few women in there. So you obviously need a woman. And I would argue that this particular woman is the greatest 20th century German. She's a legendary exile from Nazism, a poet and philosopher, an underrated musician, an inspiration to David Bowie, and a dramatist of genius received with based in gratitude by most of her fellow Germans when she came back from the US at the end of the war. And most importantly, she's a fellow resident of the Berlin district of Schöneberg. I think we need to put Marlene Dietrich in Valhalla.
Oh, she gets my vote, definitely. Right, your turn. Where else do we need to go to understand modern-day Germany?
All right, so stop number two. Let's hop on a train up to Bielefeld and then head southeast, climb a handsome forested hill and gaze up at a bronze statue of a muscly and slightly shell-shocked looking warrior in a natty hat with wings on. This guy is Arminius. In fact, he's better known in Germany as Hermann. And in 9 AD, he gave the young Roman Empire one of the most frightful drubbings in its history. Probably. I say probably, because it's pretty hard to pin down the facts about the so-called Battle of the Teutoburg Forest. We don't even know for sure where it happened, although there's now pretty good archaeological evidence that the Arminius statue is in totally the wrong place, and the Romans really got their backsides handed to them in a place called Kalkleser, about 45 miles away to the northwest. And actually, as far as I can tell, there's only one definitively rigorous work of historiography on the subject, and that is the recent Netflix series Barbarians. Have you seen it, Katja?
No, I haven't, but it's definitely on my list, because I love this myth. I mean, this isn't, to me, and I think to many other Germans of that sort of mindset, it doesn't really matter if it happened there or not. You just need some sort of mythical home place for this kind of German awe story, if you will. I mean, there's so many legends around Hermann, as you say. Arminius is known in German, and the sort of mythical proportions of this. There's student songs, you know, quite famously there's one about Tacitus and his kind of descriptions of the Germans, you know, which is still sung by university students today. It's quite intrinsically kind of woven into the national fabric, so no one really cares whether it happened there or not.
And do you know how you can tell that the screenwriters of Barbarians did their homework really diligently?
Go on.
It's because when two of the characters, I'm not going to spoil the plot, but when two of the characters finally consummate their desire for each other, they wake up the next morning in separate duvets.
as only a true German couple would do.
That's very true. I got very confused the first time I traveled to like Britain or France as well, actually, and discovered that you don't have your own duvet. That's not very easy to deal with if you're a German and you're used to your specific, you know, measurements of everything, including your own duvet per person.
Yeah. All right. So I'll give you a quick potted account of what happened and why it matters. So this is a point where the early Roman Empire under Augustus has pretty much steamrolled the various pesky Germanic tribes all the way up to the river Elbe. And he's trying to sort of consolidate his grip on the territory by co-opting the various tribal bigwigs. And one of the biggest of these bigwigs is Arminius, Hermann, who belongs to Rome's favourite pesky Germanic tribe, the Cherusci. And he's actually a Roman citizen. He speaks Latin. He's served with some distinction in the Roman army. He's a knight of the Roman Empire, so he knows their military tactics inside out. And what he does is to unexpectedly unite most of the Germanic tribes at a moment when Rome's attention is off elsewhere, putting down a vast revolt in the Balkans. And so he lures the Roman army away from its winter fortifications and into this sort of wooded terra incognita. And they cut the Roman legions to shreds. It's a total humiliation for the greatest fighting machine the world had ever known at that point. And one Roman historian, Suetonius, wrote afterwards that the Emperor Augustus had been so shocked when he heard the news that he stood there banging his head against a wall and shouting, "Bring me back my legions." I don't think we need to spell out why this myth was so central for the various German nationalists of the 19th and early 20th centuries. But what does interest me is this: Katja, as an upstanding post-nationalist German in the 21st century, how do you feel when you contemplate the benign features of Hermann the German in his natty winged hat in completely the wrong place?
Well, I was pacified with ice cream at the time, let's put it like that. I was quite disappointed, to be honest. Again, this is one of my father's great 1990s tours of let's go and explore the rest of Germany. And I thought it was an anti-climax pretty much to the entire experience because of the way that, you know, you grow up with these stories and they're sort of part of your national background. And the 19th century monument seems, despite the fact that it's now quite old, not really suitable to do that sort of thing justice. I think one of the things that it's really quite important in is this kind of idea of reinforcing the River Rhine as some sort of mythical boundary of the Germanic realm, if you will. So, you know, this kind of idea that the Romans were pushed back behind it and then couldn't really cross it again, basically, to conquer the German lands. I think that's very much enshrined in the German psyche as well. And it later matters because of the conflicts with France over these lands and this kind of idea that the Rhine needs to be reinforced. There's obviously the kind of song, for instance, that the Nazis mythologized as well about the watch on the River Rhine, you know, and all of that. So it's a kind of great big woolly myth that you can do all sorts of things with, and that is stuck, I think, in the German psyche to some extent. Right, is it my turn?
It's your turn.
Then let's go not very far, actually, to the Kyffhäuser Monument, which is, again, one of my... Actually, I quite like this one, so this one wasn't too traumatic, not too many ice creams were needed to pacify me. So this is in the Kyffhäuser mountain range in Thuringia, right in the heart, really, of Germany. Also a 19th century monument. Of course, the actual mountain isn't, but the kind of stone monument that they built on top. And it's absolutely massive. It's the third largest monument in Germany. It's 81 meters or 266 feet for the imperialist amongst you tall, and located already in itself on top of a sort of elevation of 420 meters or 1380 feet. It kind of overlooks the surrounding quite flat landscape for miles and miles and miles and really kind of sits there quite impressively on top of them. This was the idea of this was, again, 19th century idea, that it would legitimize the reign of the Hohenzollerns over all of Germany by giving it some imperial legacy. I mean, Germany really had the problem that it was the youngest of the European nation states and therefore couldn't quite look back on a national history of the kind that, say, France could. And so the idea here was to build some historical roots. And they did this quite literally. So there used to be a medieval castle in the same spot. which, incidentally, another little piece of trivia, had the deepest castle well in the world, I think, which is still there now. You can look all the way down it. But the idea was to put this monument on top of it, 19th century monument. And so they were deliberately trying to hark back to medieval myths as well. So, for instance, you do have this really rather lovely, I love it, that statue of Frederick Barbarossa there, the medieval Hohenstaufen emperor, who sort of sits there on his chair with his long, great big beard going all the way down. And the idea is that he was asleep under the mountains and would only wake up and kind of restore Germany to greatness once the country is in its hour of need. So the myth goes that his beard was growing around the table three times whilst he was asleep. And then the great emperor would wake up, and they put a statue of Wilhelm I, basically the first German emperor in the 19th century, on top of that. So he sort of stands as an equestrian statue on top of this medieval monument. And obviously the analogy is quite clear that he is indeed the reincarnation of Friedrich Barbarossa.
Yeah, and you can definitely see a certain family resemblance to British myths, such as King Arthur, or even Francis Drake, sort of waiting there, slumbering through the centuries for the moment when their nation needs them. But in Barbarossa's case, the Nazis rather spoiled things for everybody else by naming their invasion of the Soviet Union Operation Barbarossa. Do you think that has sort of damaged the mythology of the Kyffhäuser beyond repair for the present?
It's an interesting one, because the idea that they picked up was obviously the same thing. So Hitler was so obsessed with attacking the Soviet Union because of the way that it was seen as a clash of civilizations over Europe, and that's how Hitler portrayed it. And so the idea that, you know, the great medieval Barbarossa would come back and restore Germany to its greatness was, of course, incredibly powerful in the wake of defeat after the First World War and with the Treaty of Versailles. To me personally, it's hard to tell how other Germans feel about this, but I didn't make that connection for a very long time. As a child, you're introduced, certainly if you live in the region, I mean, this is in East Germany as well, so perhaps this is peculiar to me, but you're introduced to the Barbarossa myth long before you find out about Operation Barbarossa. And to me, it took quite a while, you know, once I learned about the Second World War, to even make that connection. I just love the idea of, you know, this kind of mythical king being asleep under the mountains, and there's, you know, as with Arthur, there's ravens involved in the story and all sorts of other kind of mythical elements to it. His knights are asleep with him in the cave. I certainly see it as an independent thing that was, yes, used by the Nazis, but is, of course, much older than that. But, of course, all of these national myths with Germany's very kind of conscious looking back on its own history have lost some of their kind of innocent, I would say, nature, and have certainly been politicized quite a bit.
And just a couple of things I'd like to mention in terms of bringing the Kyffhäuser forward to the present. And there's a couple of pretty curious contemporary hangovers. The first is that Wilhelm I wasn't the only German leader to have his statue up there. There was also Hindenburg, who'd basically been one of the country's military dictators during the First World War, and then the Reich president who sort of led the country during its slide into Nazism. And this Hindenburg statue was dug up while in East Germany in the 1970s, while holiday bungalows were being built on the mountain for the Stasi. And it was hushed up because it was too embarrassing. And it was excavated again in the early 2000s. And I believe Hindenburg is still lying there on his site, which is for me quite emblematic of how we've never really reached an accommodation with Hindenburg's memory. And then the second thing that is interesting is that the Kyffhäuser is used today by the Alternative for Germany, the right-wing populist AfD, for annual meetings, the Kyffhäuser Treffen, which are held by Björn Höcke, the local leader, who's one of the kind of really radical firebrands. And you can see him trying to harness and repurpose the whole mythology of the site. And another interesting detail is that Hindenburg actually founded the Kyffhäuser Bund, a sort of association for commemorating Germany's war dead, which still exists, even though it's sort of now ostensibly a kind of national shooting club. And strangely, the Kyffhäuser Bund has been quite persistent in Germany's memory landscape. And on the street where I live in Berlin, There's actually a Kyffhäuser monument to the fallen soldiers dating to back to 1930.
Yeah, it's really difficult as well to try and square that with, you know, the sort of more jolly touristy side of things. So I think it's a really good example where things don't fit neatly into the Vergangenheitsbewältigung model of let's leave everything behind in the past, because these things do still matter in the present. They're being politicized on the one hand side. On the other side, you've got, you know, people who are trying to understand German history and go there without the taint of that. So I think it's not as neat as that, and it's perhaps a good example of something that can't be compartmentalized as a relic of the past and you know, kind of let's pretend it doesn't really matter in the present anymore. I'm a little bit more at ease here on my sofa now, so where are we off to next?
Well, let's take another relatively short journey to the Völkerschlachtdenkmal.
You said that very nicely.
Which commemorates the absolutely enormous 1813 Battle of Leipzig towards the end of the sixth Napoleonic Wars. I find it really hard to keep track. Anyway, this episode is known as the Völkerschlacht, the Battle of the Nations, because the sheer titanic scale and the number of different states involved. And at the time, it was the biggest battle in European history. This is at a point where Napoleon had long ago subjugated most of the German states under the French yoke. But the tide has turned against him. The Grande Armée's long march into Russia had been an abject failure. He's in retreat. The turncoat Prussians have ganged up on him with the Russians. The Duke of Wellington is carving up his forces in Iberia. And everyone kind of takes a short break to lick their wounds. And then Napoleon tries to rescue the situation with a thrust towards Berlin, which goes wrong. So again, he's retreating back to Leipzig in Saxony to make his last stand in Germany. And so on the one side, you've got about 365,000 Russians, Prussians, Austrians and Swedes. On the other, you've got just under 200,000 French, Poles, Italians and assorted Germans from the other German states. And it's an absolute ding-dong. There's more than 500,000 men under arms, so many casualties that there are still supposedly unburied bodies left on the battlefield a year later. But once the smoke clears, Napoleon's opponents have decisively won the day and effectively liberated all of the German territory east of the Rhine. And 100 years later, a few months before the outbreak of the First World War, the city of Leipzig builds an enormous monument on the site. And it's such a weird and wonderful memorial, not least because most of the soldiers from Saxony, the surrounding state, actually fought on the wrong side at the battle. And when I went there, it was completely deserted. So what do you think it actually means in modern Germany?
I think it's lost a lot of its meaning, to be honest, as have the Napoleonic Wars overall, really. I mean, they used to be, and people forget this, the foundation myth, really, of the German nation state. I mean, this idea that, you know, the mighty Napoleon had come and fought the Germans off one by one because he was able to disunite them. And then once the Germans had finally found it in themselves to unite, I mean, Russia, you know, this entire episode of Napoleon being weakened by his invasion of Russia in 1812 is quite often just sidelined, you know, kind of this doesn't really matter. It's what matters is that Germans united against him and were then able to have this kind of last huge, great big battle of the nations, hence why it's called that in German as well, this kind of Völkerschlacht, meaning literally the Battle of the Nations, against him and won that. And as you say, you know, there were still Germans fighting on the other side. That was often conveniently forgotten as well. But it was the largest battle on European soil before the First World War. It was huge. And as a result of that, you know, you get this kind of myth-making later in the 19th century and then the early 20th century before the First World War. That establishes this as Germany's fight for its nationhood, really, and this is what compounds German national sentiment, and it did. You know, the German colours, for instance, come from there. You've got the Lützer Volunteers, who were a sort of Freikorps unit, a volunteer unit, whose uniforms, they were black with brass buttons, so that's where the gold comes from, and then the red lining, so the black, red and gold tricolour comes from that period as well. So it really is important to 19th century Germans to find some sort of history to justify the nation state that has just come into existence. But Germany has got a weird way of dealing with that now. The Napoleonic Wars they're quite sort of playful now, I'd say. There's kind of reenactments and things, and There's like real enthusiasts who are into it, but it's not really part of what Germany concentrates on anymore. It's not part of the core national history, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, the Poland Wars was just a rollicking good time for everybody involved.
Clearly. I mean, I found it really weird. I lived in Jena, where I studied in 2006, and this was, of course, the 200-year anniversary of the quite humiliating Battle of Jena and Austerlitz, where Napoleon really wiped the floor with the Prussians in 1806. And there was a huge reenactment, and I found the whole spectacle just bizarre. I mean, you had like literally thousands of people. There was even a little Napoleon on a white horse reenacting it on the original battlefield, which were just behind where a friend of mine lived at the time. So you would literally like walk out of the back of his house and, you know, you were on the battlefields there. But the way that this was all kind of a great big jolly fest with like beer and reenactments and this, that and the other, you know, just shows, I think, how the Napoleonic Wars have moved so far into the back of things because of the First and Second World War taking center stage, that people find it quite tricky to deal with it in any serious way, I guess.
All right. Well, let's go large for the last stop on our tour. Obviously, no search for Germany would be complete without a visit to Berlin. The capital may not always be the place that is most representative of a country's culture, but they do give a pretty good indication about how a nation wants to be seen.
I think that's cheating.
Katja, I'm trying to have a deep, thoughtful conversation about capitals and their relationship to national memory, and...
And you're cheating. There are dozens of memorials in Berlin, ranging from ancient excavations to those that have been built more recently, or not even built yet.
That's exactly the point. It's a memorial landscape, a collection of all the things Germany's proud of.
And many it isn't.
So where are we going to start in Berlin?
That is a good point, actually. Where are we going to start in Berlin? As you say, it's actually been described as a memorial landscape before because there are so many bits and pieces of that remind of different histories. I guess the obvious place to start, because it's perhaps the most famous and the most iconic, is the Brandenburg Gate. It was actually initially not all that iconic. I mean, it was, you know, Berlin was at the time when this was built, so we're talking in the 18th century, Berlin was still quite small, and really it had kind of like a customs wall around it where people had to stop and pay their toll as they came in, and the Brandenburg Gate was really just one of the tax gates in the city walls of Berlin. And then it was Frederick Wilhelm II, who was Frederick the Great's successor. Strangely enough, quite the opposite of him, really. He was quite a gregarious individual who just liked to spend money and wasn't particularly serious about the business of government. But he was serious about commissioning a proper Brandenburg Gate. And it was built and finished by 1791. It already had a quadriga, which was originally installed 2 years later. And the idea was that basically it would have the sort of, people weren't quite sure at the time whether she was Victory, the goddess of victory or not, but some sort of figure.
Just for the uninitiated, the quadriga is a sort of chariot type arrangement with four horses out in front.
Absolutely. And that quadriga, again, as we're on it, was the first thing that made it quite iconic, because when, going back to Napoleon now, when Napoleon first conquered Berlin, and those twin battles that we said, you know, and Austerlitz playing a key role in 1806, he took that quadriga off the Brandenburg Gate because it was the closest Berlin had to some sort of victory, triumphal arc. So he took it off there as a deliberate slight towards the Prussians, you know, to humiliate them, and took the quadriga to Paris, where he wasn't quite sure what he was going to do with it yet. But the main point was it left the Brandenburg Gate sitting there all sad. It had one iron rod left, which was sort of there to hold the quadriga in place. So you had this literally needle sticking into Berlin, with the Brandenburg Gate being completely naked and empty. And importantly, and this is where the mythmaking came from and what lifted and elevated the Brandenburg Gate to its iconic status, is that the Prussians retrieved it after they'd beaten Napoleon. And in 1814, it was put back there. And this time, a Prussian eagle and an Iron Cross, the two sort of symbols. The Iron Cross had only just been founded as a military honour, is of course still hugely important now in the context of the First and the Second World War, and still used by the Bundeswehr, by the German armed forces, as the symbol today. But it was only just founded then in the context of the Napoleonic Wars, and that was installed up there as well. And then of course later on it became very famous, you know, as the symbol of German division, because it stood right on the boundary between East and West Berlin, just on the eastern side with the Berlin Wall going around behind it. And the position of it, because people couldn't walk through it anymore, and it was right in the center, made it the symbol really of Berlin and arguably of Germany as a whole. I mean, even now it's still used, you know, as a sort of famous backdrop for football victory parades, demonstrations, New Year's Eve, there's always a huge party there. So it really has become an emblem, perhaps the emblem for the nation. Right, what's next?
I'd like to go somewhere on the outskirts of Berlin that gets a little bit overlooked in the memory landscape, but I think has a lot to say about how Berlin handles its history now. And it is the former provisions larder of Spandau Citadel, which has been turned into a museum of discarded statuary called Unveiled. And what they've done is they've taken all of the sort of unwanted statues from the city. So you've got the sort of parade of German greatness that used to line the Siegesallee, the victory boulevard through the Tiergarten. You've got these old Nazi prototypes of Aryan athletes. And right at the end, you've got this 8-ton head of Lenin lying there on its side. And I like it because it's kind of the opposite of Valhalla. It's like a kind of retirement home for past ideas of German greatness. And you talked earlier, you had this beautiful phase about studying monsters under glass. And what this is quite sort of open-ended. You're not really told how to respond to this sort of jumble of symbols of German history. And it feels very much like the embodiment of all of the positive aspects of this continual engagement with German history.
Yeah, it's an interesting one as well, because Spandau Citadel was also where the so-called Reichskriegsschatz, or literally the war chest of the German Empire, was kept. So when the German nation was founded on the back of the defeat of France in the Franco-Prussian War in 1871, they made the French pay 5 billion francs as reparations, and they were minted as like brand new coins. So the French gold was molten in, and new coins were made with the image of the first German emperor, Wilhelm I, on it. And they were all put literally into chests, into wooden boxes, and kept at Spandau Citadel. And the idea was, well, we're just going to keep them there and not use them until we have to. And when there was an argument around, you know, the outbreak of the First World War and should Germany support Austria and this, that, and the other, the argument was always made, oh, we still have our war chest sitting there in Spandau Citadel. So it became quite a sort of semi-mythical place in that respect as well, of the invincibility in many ways of the German Empire. So it really is
probably quite handy for buying Russian gas today.
Yeah, if they hadn't spent it in the first 2 days of the First World War, maybe. But yes, absolutely. Right, so where are we off to next then?
I think we should go very close to the Brandenburg Gate. In fact, just down the road to the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe.
Yeah, that was very, very controversial, wasn't it, when it was inaugurated in 2005 for various reasons, really. There were people opposed to its abstract nature. So it really, just to visualize it for those of our listeners who haven't been to it yet. So we're talking a 19,000 square meter or 200,000 feet, a square feet site, which is covered with 2,711 concrete slabs, which are arranged in a sort of grid pattern on a sloping field. I think the idea is that if you walk around in it, it's really quite disorientating because of the different slopes and the different sizes of the concrete slabs. But it was too abstract for many. So many people have argued, you know, you see children sometimes climbing around on them. They were concerns about graffiti and about kind of the way that the site would be used because it is so abstract. There was a whole debate around it at the time. Also, its location being literally at the heart of Berlin and the center of the nation.
I mean, it does have for me a very strong, blunt emotional force. And the reason why I thought it was important to talk about it is because it really does symbolize to me more than anything else the way that modern German national identity has been reconfigured around shame and all of the attendant lessons that you might draw with that. And it was Björn Höcke, who we mentioned earlier, the leader of the AfD in Thuringia, who famously described it a few years ago as a monument of shame. And in one sense, that's an outrageous thing to say, if you interpret him as saying, as he probably wanted to be interpreted as saying, that it was a shameful monument to have in the heart of your capital city. But it is also a monument, very literally, to Germany's shame. And as such, if you're thinking about how modern Germany feels about its past, it is one of the most powerful sites in the country, I think.
Absolutely. And it's also interesting that it was deliberately chosen to commemorate Jewish victims exclusively. So the official title of this monument is the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe. And that has been on the one hand side praised by many because of the, you know, sheer scale and the nature of the genocide on Jews. But other groups have campaigned since to have their own memorials built. So there is, for instance, now a memorial to the Roma and Sinti as well in Tiergarten, isn't it?
Yeah, and memorials to the gay and lesbian people who were persecuted. That's another one in the Tiergarten. But I think if the criticism was at the time that it was too abstract, then having a memorial to all the victims of the Nazi regime would have been even more abstract, to the point where it might have lost some of that force, perhaps.
Absolutely. Well, those five places alone have really given us a huge range of complex national memories, and whether Germans like it or not, and many do, these do echo into the present day. Would you say there are any central themes here? What are the aspects of Germany's past that have shaped its present identity the most?
Well, one thing that really strikes me as we've been going through this is what isn't there, and that is the First World War. I moved here in August 2018, a few months before the centenary of the armistice that ended the war. And there's basically nothing going on. And there's barely any monuments. I'm always surprised every time I come across a memorial to the war dead, as you occasionally do. And that's why I was, part of the reason I was so keen to talk about Hindenburg and the legacy of the Kufhäuser. And actually, I think the public debate in Germany that we've seen since the start of the war in Ukraine shows just how profound a hold the First World War has a modern political culture here. So one example is both Angela Merkel and Olaf Scholz were very strongly influenced by reading Christopher Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers, which argues that the great powers of Europe basically stumbled into an eminently avoidable conflict that lasted decades. And Scholz has said himself several times that he doesn't want to be like Kaiser Wilhelm II and blunder myopically into a cycle of escalation that could destroy the continent. Personally, I think that's based on a slightly shallow and solipsistic reading of Clark's book and the causes of the war. And I'd like to see a more open and extensive engagement with the legacy of the conflict and what it means in modern Germany.
Yeah, it's really difficult for Germany because when the Second World War was over and Germany had to find a way of coming to terms with itself, with the fact that two wars had emanated from its soil, many people in Germany as well as externally, but even in Germany, I would say even more obsessively, were looking for continuities between the two. And if you do that, then the First World War becomes simply a prelude to the catastrophe, the even bigger catastrophe of the Second World War and the genocide that accompanied it. And I think that is exactly the problem. So you end up with the First World War as an explanation for the Second, rather than a conflict in its own right. Whilst actually in historiography, a lot more nuanced approaches have been found. So the First World War is there often described as the Urkatastrophe, the arch catastrophe of the 20th century, which really triggered the sort of wave of violence and the humiliation and all the rest of it that then led to the Second World War. So there's still a causal explanation there, but it views the First World War as a part of that history rather than just a prelude. And I think that hasn't really trickled through into kind of a more widely seen approach. It also doesn't help that a lot of the sites of the First World War that are important to German myth-making and should therefore perhaps be dismantled or looked at, they're actually not on German soil anymore. So when you think that the Tannenberg Memorial, for example, that was there in Eastern Europe as a memorial to that battle that was fought against the Russians in the East, where Hindenburg initially, by the way, was actually buried as well. And his body had to be very quickly retrieved during the Second World War before the Russians could get to it because they destroyed that memorial. A lot of the memories, the national memories of the First World War have vanished with the lands that aren't part of Germany any longer. So, you know, I think that's part of it as well, is that it is just, it seems like more ancient history because of the huge impact that the Second World War has had.
And just to address that elephant in the room, how do you see the Second World War and the modern understanding in Germany of that war overshadowing and influencing the debate around the war in Ukraine today?
Yeah, I think it's played a very unfortunate role in that. I mean, I've described the Second World War before as the black hole of German national history. It sucks everything into its orbit that came before and everything that came after, and everything is shaped in that kind of context. I mean, Germany likes to talk about its responsibility, but about its guilt as well. And I think the two are conflated all too often. So this idea that Germany was involved, and not just involved, but caused the Second World War and therefore needs to stay out of all subsequent wars, has been used by many people on the left in particular in Germany today, who've been arguing for kind of an approach to the Ukraine conflict that doesn't involve Germany delivering weapons or even helping in any shape or form, but instead sort of stand by under this false umbrella of nie wieder Krieg, or no, you know, never again war, which has been used really in the context of the Second World War.
Yeah, I would absolutely endorse all of that. And you could talk about these two strands of interpretation. There's nie wieder Krieg, never again war, as you said. This idea that because of Germany's shame, its responsibility is to, or its duty is to, try to shut down conflicts as soon as possible. And then there's nie wieder Auschwitz, this idea that there is an active responsibility not to allow crimes against humanity or genocides to happen again. And those are two, I think, very different things. And back in our first episode of this podcast series, we talked to Rudolf Scharping, who was the Social Democrat defense minister who oversaw the first overseas combat deployment of German troops since the Second World War. When we asked him about this, he said he didn't see a distinction between these two strands, but I'm not so sure. I really do think that in many ways, the war in Ukraine is forcing Germany to choose between these two interpretations of history, at least to some extent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also wonder where Germany goes from here. I mean, because it now has to finally, the Ukraine conflict has effectively forced it to come up with a more distinct or kind of more concrete version of itself. So what is Germany? What does it stand for? Where does it go from here? It has to almost reinterpret its 21st century identity, moving away from this kind of completely hands-off approach to all military conflict and indeed all conflict in the world. So where do we go from here? Has Germany got a distinct 21st century identity, do you think, that is in the making?
Well, I hate to say this, since we spent so long taking a tour of all of these sort of quite wistful sites in Germany. But as far as I'm concerned, with the exception of Berlin, 4 out of 5 of them are basically dead in terms of their potential significance for a kind of meaningful and self-confident German identity today. They're very much the old Germany. And I think that's why it's helpful to go back over this process of how the myths originated in the first place, because these national stories obviously do need to be made anew. And you can certainly see that this has happened to a great extent with the darker side of 20th century German history in places like Auschwitz, Buchenwald, and the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. But I also think that there is a need for more positive or affirmative symbols of what it means to be a German today, apart from the Allianz Arena, of course.
Yeah, I mean, they're still struggling to come up with new memorials as well to try and capture that. One of the things, for instance, that is built in Berlin is a new memorial to German unity. So you have this, they're now calling it the Einheitswippe or the unity swing.
Seesaw.
Yeah, seesaw. So the idea that, you know, you have a new memorial there where it's basically like a great big bowl where if enough people move from one end to the other, you can swing the whole thing around, and it's supposed to represent the peaceful revolution of 1989. But again, you have so many people arguing we've already got symbols to German unity, such as the Brandenburg Gate. And I would cautiously go the other way from you. I would say those old memorials do matter. They just need to find a new meaning. Germany does need to look back beyond, in my view, further back, than the Second World War and even the First World War at its origins, and try and find meaning, I think, historical meaning. You can't just pretend that Germany started to exist either in 1949 or in 1989, because it didn't. People will go back further than that, and that needs to be, I think, in my view, slotted into a wider view of German history, and, you know, in which Germany comes to terms with all of its past and not just with the Second World War.
They may not agree on much, but at least they duffed up the French and the Italians.
Yeah, I'm not...
You never know, maybe Olaf Scholz is the figure. Maybe one day a grateful nation will erect dozens of statues to him for liberating Germany from the tyranny of Russian gas.
Yeah, you always got to be careful. Yeah, rekindling those sorts of memories, there's always a bit of a danger that that goes down a very different route from what you wanted to. Well, as much as I've enjoyed revisiting the national traumas and also my personal traumas, I'm afraid we are out of time.
We didn't even do the ice cream or the Bismarck Towers, catch it.
I know, but we can always catch up on those. I always have time for ice cream and Bismarck Towers.
Anyway, thank you to very patient listeners for joining us for this final episode of the new mini-series, The New Germany. It's been such a lot of fun. And if you've enjoyed all our ramblings, please do let us know.
On Twitter, with a rating for the podcast, or by feedback directly to the Körber Stiftung.
And as always, you can find this and all other episodes of the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much any other podcast app or website. If you'd like to find out more about the Foundation or Germany's politics and history more generally, visit the Körber Stiftung's webpage.
Well, Oliver, this is it. Our very own Zeitenwende. The end of an era. We've reached the end of our podcast mini-series.
Well, who knows? Whether it's the end of an era or the dawn of a new one remains to be seen. What we do know is that it's been an absolute pleasure to have you, dear listeners, with us. Thank you for joining us on our exploration of the new Germany, and it's about time I bought Katja an ice cream.
I agree. Auf Wiederhören and bis bald.